Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, Dave, you heard it here first. I said there's a piece in Rolling Stone about the CD boom. Didn't you predict this on this very podcast?
Never mind you heard it here first. I said it here first.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure I wasn't the first. But I've been going on for a little while. I think actually during lockdown I've been going on about, you know, because on the rare occasions when I go into town, I always buy a CD. And, you know, I just think, CDs are due for some kind of comeback, back into favor. And there's a big piece in Rolling Stone. I think it was a big piece I read somewhere else, ringing the bell for the same phenomenon. And, there's loads of people trying to argue for the unique properties of the CD. I don't know if they're that unique. But the fact is that at the core of this, it seems to me, is you have to have one physical format that's roughly affordable.
Well, it's affordable and it doesn't take up a lot of space.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and it sounds incredible. And I don't know. It's funny. I was reminded of this the other day, just how much you value the physical format. When I received a copy of this in the post, this is the new Half Man, Half Biscuit
record, right?
Sent by Nigel Blackwell of the group. And it's so sweet. And various people, Nigel Tassel and Stuart McConey, various others, have printed their little notes that he's written. And there's a handwritten note. This is so old school. This is a guy, I'm not sure if he has a computer. He certainly doesn't have a mobile phone. He certainly doesn't do any social media. This is a piece of kind of old school lined paper, torn in half so as not to waste any. And the note, so sweet, says, "Ahoy there, Mark. I hope this finds you in good health, and I apologise in advance should that situation change upon listening to our latest caterwaul." And this is it. It's great. With tracks like "I'm Getting Buried in the Morning," which has the immortal line, "See you later, Undertaker. In a while, necrophile." That's good, isn't it? I know. And there's "Test of the Dormobiles" about this incapacity with this girl who has a van. She's Betamax and he's VHS. They don't really get on. "Midnight Mass Murder." Oh, it's terribly good. It's fantastic. But isn't that's lovely. The idea you receive the record physically with a little note, handwritten note. It matters.
But the great argument for the CD or the LP or anything, as opposed to streaming, is it's just a simple old thing. It's out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
Is that if you haven't got the physical thing somewhere near you, it's very difficult to think, "Oh, I feel like hearing that," or whatever. You know, because everything else is just, they're just kind of numbers out there.
It doesn't
there
seem
somewhere.
Like an event, does it? Clicking something and just listening to
it. No, I suppose
putting
not.
It on. You know.
So anyway, you know, we were ahead of the game on that one.
We were ahead of the curve
in predicting the comeback of the CD. I must throw in this piece of correspondence from James Wilkinson. I thought you might like it. He says, "Did you see that Woody Woodmansey has been left out of the lineup for the upcoming tour of Holy Holy?"
I saw that.
They're very good David Bowie tribute band he formed with Tony Visconti.
Tony Visconti's band, that's right.
On account of him being unvaccinated. Is this the first instance of a band losing a member due to medical differences?
Good. Because various people have refused to play venues that insist on COVID passports and all that. But has anybody been booted out of a group for refusing the vaccine? I don't know. Not to my
probably. There probably has been a case. I wouldn't
how much
surprised.
Do you have to care to feel? How strong do you have to feel to edit yourself out of a group in a tour like that? It's incredible, isn't it? You think you go along with it?
If you know any more examples, we want to hear them.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So that link of Mike Campbell talking about the making of Boys of Summer, fantastic. We've both seen it. It's fantastic. It's just 8 minutes long. What a brilliant talker. And
he's a really good talker.
He's really, and he speaks unedited for 7 or 8 minutes and just explains how they came to make the Boys of Summer. And it's one of those amazing things where you hear these songs, you've heard them a million times, and you just imagine that they were always terribly considered and refined and organized and came out of the box and were just, you know, they just polished them up. And no, this was a kind of spontaneous, almost an accident, really, wasn't it?
Well, it's sort of 83, 84 or something like that. It all starts with him and Tom Petty used to go over to Leon Russell's house. Because Leon, you know, they kind of knew each other, you know, and this is before they'd really happened. And there was a guy called Roger Lynn who used to work in Leon Russell's house and used to disappear into a back room regularly. And they used to say, "What's Roger Lynn doing in there?" He said, "He's inventing a drum machine." And they all went, "Wow, what's a drum machine?" It's extraordinary to reflect.
I know.
In the early 80s, that was still a
In fact, the Lynn drum.
Very strange concept. And of course, he got his first Lynn drum, and Mike Campbell managed to buy a Lynn drum from him at mate rates and took it home. And as musicians will do, he just tinkered with it. He just played with it again and again and again. And it's a classic case of what Alex Gold frequently says, is that what musicians like most of all is a toy. They like a new piece of equipment. And that was an absolute classic case. So there was no instruction manual. There was nobody to tell him how to use it. He just sat up all night, he says, playing with this until he developed some kind of rhythm pattern that he just liked. You know, it was within his capability. And then he started playing a guitar figure over the top of it. And eventually he thought, you know, I've got something catchy here. It's the beginnings of something here.
And then he took it to Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, didn't he? And they said it was too jazzy.
Took it to Tom Petty and Jimmy Iovine, the producer. And they said, well, it's too jazzy for what we're doing at the moment, but there's something there. And so later on, Jimmy Iovine gets in touch with Campbell and says, "You've been talking to Don Henley. Don Henley is making another solo record and is looking for ideas and songwriting partners and so forth. Why don't you take it to him?" So it's all kinds of things in this story that made me want to stop and just reflect on the reality of musicians' lives. So Mike Campbell goes over to Don Henley's house and he's never met him before. Yeah. That's the thing. You know, you tend to think that songwriting partnerships start from mates. There's a rapport between them. No, he didn't know the guy at all. He took along his cassette of his drum machine pattern. And he and Henley sat at a different end of a long table. And he gave it to him and he put the cassette in the cassette machine. And Henley, he says, "Listen to the whole thing without cracking any kind of expression."
No, he thought he hated it, didn't he? And then he went home, and I think the next day Henley rang up and said, "I have written the best set of lyrics I've ever written in my life."
I think it was less than a day, he says.
Amazing,
he rang him up. Really?
But then I think all sorts of technical problems happened that he tried then to make the proper recording. He had to load up the drum pattern on a cassette and it wouldn't load.
It wouldn't load.
And it looked like he was going to lose it. And therefore the entire song was in the balance by some miracle it loaded.
You see, this is around about the same time, Mark, that you and I used to do stuff on Amstrad computers.
That's
right. Remember? And frequently, journalists used to ring you in the middle of the night saying, I'm distraught. I think I've lost my
4,000 words on Devo.
Whatever. Yeah. And you'd have to talk them down like suicides off a ledge. You know, there's a way we can preserve this. Well, Mike Campbell found himself in a very similar position with his golden little track for Boys of Summer.
Yeah.
He thought this is going to be, and he finally got it to load. And he said to them, quickly, tape it. You've only got one go, you know. And so they did this. And then they started making the record. And it was about a week to make the record.
But
and
then they were mixing it, weren't they?
And no, but hold on a second. First of all, before they get to the mixing stage, Henley says, I've decided I want to sing it in a different key. It'll be better if we sing it in a different key. So then he has to go back and tinker with this thing so it can work in a different key. And that takes ages. And then when they get to the point where they're finally mastering this thing, he notices they're running the tape and then they've got the mastering machinery here, the disc cutter, whatever.
And there's tape spooling out of the machine.
The backing is coming off the tape. He thinks, this is going to get lost again. And then some guy manages to put it back together again. And this absolutely golden record comes out of all this tinkering and confusion. And as Mike Campbell reflects, he says, that song's been very good to me. It actually bought my house.
That's right. It's a beautiful moment. It ends with a moment, doesn't it, when he is in Don Henley's Porsche and they hear it on the radio and it's played by, I don't know which radio station it is, three times in succession. And he thinks, that is a hit record. It's just lovely. But I love that. I love that whole thing. I love that thing with accidents, that serendipity about records, don't you?
And it's also fascinating. It draws attention to the fact, as we frequently reflected here, that making records is above all a collaborative process. You know, it's not it's not one genius in a room having a brilliant idea.
That's the song. The record's a completely different thing.
It's loads and loads of people pitching in with loads of different things. And of course, the other thing that struck me when I was listening to it this week and reading about it, because I've just become obsessed last week with this, is that one thing about the Boys of Summer's success meant a lot in America, doesn't mean anything in Britain at all, is the title, The Boys of Summer, and it's in the lyrics, you know, my love for you will still be here after the Boys of Summer have gone. The Boys of Summer is the title of one of America's most cherished and celebrated sports books. It's a book written by, I think, Roger Kahn in the 1970s.
So we don't have that connection at all, but I didn't know that.
It's about, the Boys of Summer is about the Brooklyn Dodgers team of the mid-50s and what happened to them afterwards. So baseball in America is like cricket. It's actually nostalgia. That's the appeal of it. Baseball people always think life was better back then, you know, the golden days.
That's right.
And so the Boys of Summer as a title has that kind of emotional freight to it, you know. So, you know, he took that, quite rightly he took that, you know. So Don Henley clearly has a huge part in it. Clearly, Don Henley's a remarkable singer and he wrote a really good song. But how many people contributed to that, to the kind of masterpiece that eventually came out at the end of it is just amazing to reflect upon.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Oh, we're joined by Patreon supporter, legend of the Word in Your Ear Massive, Mr. Keith Eddsley. On the occasion of his birthday, you know, there are major events in the calendar. The Queen has two birthdays. I'm sure Keith eventually is going to move to a similar position. But it is your birthday once again, Keith.
Thank you very much. It was
congratulations
yesterday, but thank you very much.
I was yesterday.
How did you celebrate this great event?
Well, I was working because it's market day.
Of course.
Remember, I'm an esteemed trader on St. Albans Market.
In good standing.
That was very good. So market day, and then came home and a very nice, Alex would approve, homemade vegan sausage mash and onions meal. You can't beat SMO. Sausage mash and onions.
Vegan sausage.
Homemade, Mark. My lovely Julia had crafted the vegan sausages herself.
All right.
What's the principal ingredient?
It's actually made out of seitan, and seitan is effectively seitan. There's a place in Hackney called the Temple of Seitan. Actually, it's a very nice restaurant. And it would be in Hackney, wouldn't it?
It would.
I've eaten
that. What is seitan? Is that an acronym or what is that? Where did that come from?
No. So basically, it's made out of gluten wheat flour. So if you think of anything that's gluten free, this is the polar opposite. So all right. The gluten that comes out of gluten free,
they go and put it towards the seitan.
It goes in a big heap, and basically it's flour, and you can make meat or sausage or stuff like that. So we do. You kind of combine it with other things, herbs and spices, and then you steam it into a sausage, and then you fry it or grill it like a normal sausage.
So those were your birthday festivities. So today is dedicated to just recovering, presumably.
Yes, it's dedicated to recovering. We usually go do a long walk on a Sunday and Monday. Doing it tomorrow, but today we're having it off. It's been a bit grotty out.
It's been What's your filthy. Definition of a long walk?
So on a Monday and a Sunday, we do about 13 kilometres, so about 7 miles.
That's a serious walk. Do you know who the great walkers in rock are? Do you know, Keith? It's a select list, this.
There is a select list.
It's quite interesting.
Kimberly Roo.
Kimberly Roo of Katrina, you know,
walked right around the entire coast of Britain. Oh, I tell you another, Art Garfunkel.
This is what I was going to say. Art Garfunkel walked across America, I think, on more than one occasion.
Yeah.
Didn't he even like walk to China or something?
Something astonishing.
Just
he has got the advantage that he's about 6'2", so it takes less time than knocks a week off it. Paul Simon would have called a slightly longer time.
Billy Bragg, yeah, go on.
Well, I mean, not quite rock, but on the fringes. Stuart McConey was head of the Ramblers.
Stuart's a serious Rambler. Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
I think Janet Street Porter was a.
Predecessor of in that office. I think. Yeah. Yes. But they particularly go and ramble really pretty places, don't they?
Really
photogenic places. It's not a rambler in rock, not a walker in rock, but he's a well-known walker. It's Will Self is a well-known walker, isn't he?
He is.
Because Will Self did this whole thing, and I'm not quite convinced by this. He says that if you don't walk someplace, you don't know it. You don't really have contact with it. And so he did this thing in the States where he would fly anywhere to go and publicize his books. But once he got to the airport, he would walk into the city, you know, which very often quite can...
That is, and you're walking down some horrendous freeway.
There's nothing to walk on in a lot of cases. They've kind of removed everything to walk on. So anyway,
another great walker. Very quickly, Tom Holland, the historian.
Of course.
Walked recently, didn't he? 45 miles across London, going visiting all sorts of sites.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Keith, have you got any quick questions that you want to?
Anything you'd like to raise on the occasion of your birthday?
Yes. I was thinking about this the other day, and obviously music, the way music's produced, the way we consume it, and the way technology has moved forward has moved vastly in the last 50 or 60 years. And I mentioned before when in one of David's books, he mentions about Sounds Room, where you'd sit from a big hi-fi and you'd sit central between the speakers. And the key thing about growing up was all about stereo. Oh, have you got a new stereo? I want to upgrade my stereo. And it was all about listening in stereo, so you got the left and the right channel. Well, now, kids either listen on a phone and may not have headphones, or a Bluetooth speaker. And it seems to me we've lost the concept of the left and right channel.
I think you're right, actually, Keith. My offspring, I wouldn't call them children, they're grown up, they never remark on that kind of thing, the kind of position that they occupy with relation to the sound. But then again, there's a kind of expectation that the sound will be good and it'll be kind of rounded, and you know, there's a certain kind of sound that emerges. You know, I've got one of those little Bose speakers, you know, those Bluetooth speakers. And that's mono, but it's really good mono. You know.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm not knocking that they're really good, but I'm thinking, you know, with the advantage in technology, and you could. I mean, my my oldest is a musician, and he kind of mixes and records everything through his Mac, like a load of people do, you know, and that's amazing. But I've made sure he and my younger son have both got proper hi-fi setups. So I bought them all separate with turntables and everything.
You will bloody well listen to the stuff on this. None of your ridiculous iPhones. But that's a really good point. Do people, because, you know, if you listen to, I don't know, sort of Steely Dan records or something like that, when we were kids, you would hear, because you're listening to them often on headphones, you would hear tiny details, little Steely bits of Dan, instrumentation that you'd never noticed before.
Steely Dan, exactly, because it follows on from a question I put in a pod about 3 or 4 weeks ago, when I said I bought a new amplifier, not brand new, but a good old Mr. eBay, a Marantz amplifier. Other amplifiers are available. The price of your amplifier may go up or may go down. I bought this Marantz amp and I played Jack of Speed by Steely Dan, which is absolutely phenomenal because, as you say, Mark, you get nuances left and right, and it's a great thing to test on.
It's an incredible record.
And I don't, although saying that, you know, we are going for people listening to Steely Dan aren't going to possibly be 17 to 25. They may be. It may be their parents or possibly grandparents have suggested them. But they're going to, I don't think the music that's produced today, they get the full benefit and appreciation from. I know I'm a grumpy.
But don't you think? But don't you think? If you look at the history of recorded sound, the technology has changed absolutely all the time.
Oh, phenomenal.
And every time it changes, people think it's changing for the better. It's just changing for different, really.
Yeah.
Very, very often the case. And, you know, people don't have hi-fi setups. But I think a huge number of younger people do listen on headphones nowadays. I mean, people spend money on headphones that previously they used amounts on headphones that previously they used to spend on a home system, don't they? It's been hundreds of pounds.
You could spend. I always get purely just to gloat one of the hi-fi magazines every month, just to have a read on. And yeah, there's headphones in there for like £5,000-£10,000.
That's ridiculous.
I mean, I've got a couple of decent pairs that weren't anywhere near that. You know, like just over 100, but they're still perfectly good.
My old magazine editor is coming out of me now. You'd immediately think you want to write a piece about that. You want to get somebody to listen to the same record on a £10,000 headphones, £5,000 headphones, right down to, you know, this kind of thing, and note what the difference was. I'd be really interested.
Well, it's all so subjective, and I think it's all to do with what you know about what you're listening to. And what you know about what you've paid for what you're listening to.
Yeah. The other interesting fact I would say is obviously with the reemergence of the vinyl boom, obviously, you know, the likes of us have never left the vinyl boom. Yeah. But people, I don't know, 18, 19, and they like the idea of vinyl and they've seen it and they buy themselves a vinyl player, not a turntable, a vinyl player.
A vinyl player,
yeah.
Well, that's usually a small box with built-in speakers. And they're probably going to get the same, if not worse, quality than just from a pair of, you know, iPhone headphones or from a pair of headphones. So, yes, they've got a lovingly warm, you know, a thing that gives you a lovingly warm sound when it's played on relatively good stuff. This reminded me of when I was going through my collection the other day and looking at Tubular Bells. And on the back of Tubular Bells, it says down the bottom, along the lines of... this must be played on a proper hi-fi, not on a tin box. If so, hand it into a police station.
Is it really?
On the bottom of Tubular Bells, on the back of the sleeve. Back of the sleeve, it's got that. I'll take a photo of it later and I'll tweet it.
That's really interesting. And that will start this will run and run, actually. Instructions, this is open to everybody, actually. Instructions on the back of records about how you should play them and so forth. You know, we were talking recently a record that was made to be played. This record must be played loud at low volume. Well, I can't remember what the record was.
Who was it? Was it Dr. Feelgood?
No, I don't think it was Dr. Feelgood. Whatever. But little instructions written about how you might play stuff on records We want to hear them. I'm sure you've got your own samples that you can add to the conversation. Keith, thanks very much for joining us. And thanks
it's a
very
pleasure
much
as always.
For raising that important burning issue, which will now animate the massive over the next week. And obviously you've had a good birthday and have a good recovery day, Keith.
Yes.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Bit.
I like that that picture you tweeted that was sent to you of the two football players. It's a real old heads gag, isn't it? It's two guys. You can just see the back of their shirts. This was their both Cardiff City members, I think.
In the defence, are they? Aren't they in the defence?
They are the defence for Cardiff City.
So their defensive pairing is okay, Mark.
Here it is. It's McGuinness Flint. But to me... And to you, to people of a certain age, that is hilarious.
Alex looking blank, absolutely blank.
I was starting to think there's got to be more of them. There must be like a Manfred and a man. You know what I mean? Or a Hall and an Oates.
Yes, that's what we want.
Well, Spurs have got a son. So all you need is a Mumford. There must be a Mumford somewhere. Get them together for the Vogue.
Just get one in for one game. Maybe all those
friends and a Ferdinand. There's got to be somewhere.
Absolutely fantastic.
I love it. But actually, on that note, I don't know if I dropped into a bit of the Kidderminster Harriers game against West Ham yesterday, the FA Cup tie, which is amazing. Had Kidderminster won, of course, it would have been, I think I'm right in saying, the most historic defeat in the entire history of the FA Cup. Because
that's fighting talk.
115 levels places, below them.
Places, not levels, surely no. No, places.
Places, I think, that's right, levels, sorry, places. But the crowd, the camera occasionally panned in on Kidderminster supporter, Robert Plant, which I thought was really great.
Well,
he's
a local.
Wolves and all that. But
Kidderminster, I think, is his kind of patch, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
He no doubt lives out there.
But I thought that was really commendable because, you know, you get all these kind of Ed Sheerans going on about Chelsea and Adele about Spurs and, you know, they might go. I think it highly other something in Adele's case, doesn't live in this country. But there's Robert Plant, you know, in a place that it's a 6,000 seater, only 3,000 seats. And there he is, probably with his pucker pie and his, you know, watery pint of lager in disguise. I remember meeting him at John Peel's funeral, and he has this disguise, which he puts on this woolly hat and stuffs all his hair inside it. And I was really impressed that he was there.
No, good man. Definitely.
That's good, isn't it?
Good for him. So, Alex, any other business? You sent me this thing from Giles Fraser?
Giles Fraser,
Five in Five. Go on, set this up for us. Tell us about this.
So it's all about all the bands, all the artists that have made five consecutively great records I think in 5 years.
In 5 years.
In 5 years.
Yes. And so I don't know. I've got a list in front of me. I don't know if these are the ones that you sent through to you. So it's got obviously the Beatles between 1965 and 69, Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, The White Album, and Abbey Road. The Rolling Stones between 1969 and 74, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, Exile on Main Street, Goat's Head Soup. Oh, I don't know. Goat's Head Soup. I don't know.
I think that's pushing it a bit.
I think you might.
Fairly,
I think
you're close to the wind there.
Yeah, yeah. And then if you go, but if you try and go earlier in the Stones, you end up with Their Satanic Majesty's Request. So you're
terrible
scuppered.
Record.
You're scuppered each
a
way you go.
Record.
The Who between 1969 and 73, Tommy, Who's Next, Quadrophenia. Oh, he says Doubles Count Too, I think. Oh,
I don't know about that.
Elton John, 9 albums, including Elton John, Tumbleweed Connection, Madman Across the Water, Honky Chateau.
9 albums in 5 years.
Well, he put out an insane amount of records, didn't he? There was, I think, 1971. I think there's 3 Elton John records.
Yeah.
There's Madman Across the Water. There's, and also it gets complicated because some records came out slightly later in America than came out in Britain. You know, that's what happened in those days. And there was a soundtrack to a movie called Friends and so forth. Anyway, he also mentioned Steely Dan, 72 to 77, Can't Buy a Thrill, Countdown to Ecstasy, Pretzelogic, Katie Lloyd, The Royal Scam, and Asia. Are those old, 72, 73?
Those are good records. That works for me.
They're good records. But then, you know, they're a bit slimmer. The pickings are a bit slimmer after that, aren't they, Alex? Although you did suggest Elvis Costello, 77 to 82.
Yeah.
My Aim Is True, this year's model. Armed Forces, Get Happy, Trust, an Imperial Bedroom.
These are all Giles' suggestions, by the way.
Oh, were they all?
Dylan, yeah. Dylan, another side of Bob Dylan, Bring It All Back Home, Highway 61, Blonde on Blonde. What was after that? John Wesley Harding. They were all within 5 years, weren't they? That's a good...
There must have been a longer gap.
I tell you, don't qualify because they didn't make 5 albums, but produced 4 albums within 5 years, was the Smiths. All 4 of the Smiths records are great. And Hatful of Hollow, I suppose you could call that 5th, is also a really amazing record.
You see, I think Giles is asking the question, will we ever see this again? The answer is no.
No.
Because people make records...
Here's another one.
People don't make records far more slowly now than they used to do. They used to, I mean, the Beatles made so many records because for most of their career, they made 2 albums a year.
Yeah.
It was only a year of Sgt. Pepper that, 96, no, they put out no album at Christmas 66, did they? Which was unusual. They put out the collection of Beatles oldies instead. And it's quite interesting, though, because I was thinking about, We've been in this bloody war has been going on for 2 years now. We three have been staring at each other via Zoom since the great unpleasantness descended. 2 years, okay? Almost, you know, it's coming up in a few weeks' time, isn't it? It'll be 2 years.
Yeah.
And you think, what did the Beatles do in 2 years?
I know. It's incredible, isn't it? It's Hard Day's Night.
The Beatles were recording Hard Day's Night. I worked this out the other day. I think it was April 64. They were recording Hard Day's Night in April 64. And in April 66, they were recording Tomorrow Never Knows.
It was great. But yeah, but did they put out over 100 podcasts? I think not.
There you go.
There are a load of people who produced 5 really great records in a row. Leonard Cohen did and Nick Lowe did, but they didn't do it within 5 years. I mean, Leonard Cohen made a handful of records in his entire life, doesn't he? One about every 10 years or whatever.
Yeah. But then I was also thinking, you know, we were discussing earlier, you know, the great story of the writing and recording of The Boys of Summer. And I think it was a turning point in all kinds of ways, you know, because they obviously worked on it quite a long time. And I don't think anybody, you know, in the years before then, you know, certainly in the 60s and the early 70s, nobody worked on a record that long. And I think, now you can either agree with me or disagree with me, Alex. I'm particularly looking at you here.
Okay.
Okay. In the days of studios, and kind of you booked your time and so forth, and you turned up with your instruments and you played, there was a limit to how long you could spend making a record. Once you are making records in your own studios, and once you're involving kind of toys, you know, rhythm machines, I don't know, all kinds of things, you can go on forever. And so that's one of the reasons why records for the last 30 years have taken far longer to make than they used to. Because it's kind of indulgence, isn't it? And you were talking about this the other day. I can't remember what we were talking about. We were talking about preparing to make albums. You said people do pre-production nowadays.
Well, surely the Stone Roses story is that magic. Isn't that a very good example of that? They went into the studio in Cornwall, didn't they, for their second album.
Went out for a quick cheeky spliff, and then 5 years later.
5 years later, that's right.
And the record.
They kept saying they didn't have the right amps. They didn't have, it was just this displacement activity. And it was weeks of bringing in new drum machines and just a bit of equipment and amps and stuff, and then before they even started recording. So, I don't know. Too much choice.
There comes a point where there's an old saying, a mix is never finished, it's merely abandoned.
I'm sure.
That's kind of how it works. And I think with increasing budgets and better studios, the inclination has been to hold on to this notion of your perfect vision for longer and longer and longer. I guess the anomaly is the Beatles, because obviously they had the run of Abbey Road, yet they, you know, they only
worked slowly later on because and at the time, you know, I can remember, and Mark will be able to remember, when Sergeant Pepper came out, they said, they've done a scarcely believable 500 hours in the studio or whatever. And you think, nowadays, people do that on a B-side. It just seemed ridiculous at the time, because prior to that, the Beatles had been, you know, you had a certain number of weeks to make a record, at the end of which you had a tour. Or you had to do a telly, or you had your Christmas show fixed up. And the amazing thing is, even when they had the run of the studio, as you say, they kind of got on with it.
You know? They were a live band, though, and bands of...
Well, they weren't in 69. They weren't in late 66, 67, because they'd stopped that totally. But they still kind of got on with it, you know?
They never wasted any time.
I don't think they did.
Extraordinary things like Yellow Submarine. That wasn't a waste of time. It was just a huge, great experiment in creating lots of kind of sound collage and sound effects and nonsense. But it all finished up with the record. Whereas Pink Floyd spent ages bringing in bits of equipment, didn't they? And then trying them out.
Absolutely.
It didn't work.
Absolutely. Well, famously, didn't they start recording and your mate, John Leckie, was working with them.
Yeah.
And I can't remember which record, but those. And they've just recorded a track. He said, what shall I put this down as on the tape box? And they said, nothing. And so he wrote, nothing. And then they did another track. And he said, what shall I put it down as? So, nothing to. You know, they were just kind of mucking about.
Yeah.
We don't know how, we'll recognize where we're going when we get there, kind of thing, rather than having any objective. But also, if you're working in the old-fashioned way, you had a George Martin standing there going, tapping his watch, saying, when are you going to finish this? Yeah. You finished it. Whereas if you can noodle on endlessly, and also I've always had this theory with bands that they get nervous about releasing stuff. They like making it. They don't like putting it out. Because as soon as you put it out, you're going to get it in the neck straight away.
Yeah, you're going to be judged. You're going to be judged. And also you think that the longer you can procrastinate, the better you can make it, which is often absolute nonsense. Bruce Springsteen being a really good example.
Oh, absolutely.
Going in later on and just removing all the things he'd overdubbed, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So what else is there in any
I've got
business?
One quick query.
Go on.
Probably to you, really, David, because I don't know if Alex Harvey's your bag magic, but Alex Harvey, who I used to love, died 40 years ago on the 4th of February 1982. And my question to you is, and I saw the Alex Harvey Band only once, you know, singing Next and doing Delilah and doing all that kind of German cabaret rock, you know, and Sal Clemens with his painted face and Alex kind of hanging off the scaffolding, you know. And has there ever been anybody continuing that? Was there anyone like him before? And has there been anyone like him since? Because I don't know. I watched Next on Whistletest, the Jacques Brel song, that little clip on the day he died. And it's phenomenal, actually. It's an amazing performance. But it's not rock music. That's an old cabaret song, but he's so unusual and different.
I have to confess, Alex Harvey kind of passed me by.
Passed you by.
And but clearly, you know, people really admired him and loved him. And clearly he was a complete one-off. And, you know, in answer to your question, was there anybody before? Not as successfully before, I don't think. And kind of nobody since, really. You know, he was always the guy. He was a big guy at festivals, wasn't he? You could put him on in front of even the most hostile crowd.
He'd win them over.
And he'd win them over.
Also, he was so much older than I realized. When I saw him, you know, I saw him, he was nearly 40. You know, that was in 1974. Nearly 40. So he didn't kind of really have any real success till he was 38. He was born in 1935. 5 years. He supported the Beatles at one point. They supported Johnny Gentle, who was Beatles.
The Beatles.
And even then, he would have been, God, I don't know. He was 7 years older than Paul McCartney, which is astonishing.
Yeah, it is, so really. Isn't it? So that's 40 years ago.
40 years ago.
Pretty much now. Okay. So one thing on any other business, which we don't stress anything like enough, is that it really does help if you review these things or give them a thumbs up or whatever it is on your podcast carrier or whatever platform you happen to be on. All that kind of thing really does make a difference. So, you know, if you listen to this and you enjoy it, please register your approval somewhere. And if you'd like to be one of our Patreon supporters, details are at patreon.com/wordinyourear.
And I think we should plug the Will Hodgkinson Word in Your Attic, because it's so good. We interviewed, we talked to Will, who's the music critic of the Times and an author, and he was just terrifically good.
He was very good.
He told this great story about choosing, there's a lesson here, choosing music to be played at your wedding reception. Yeah. And he had Alone Again or by Love, I think, when they're walking up the aisle. And then he asked the DJ to play a particular song, which is Lady Jane by the Stones, because his wife,
which is from, sorry, we're gonna drag this out a bit. You will know, Stones fans, that is from Aftermath. Okay, so it was playing it from a copy of Aftermath. Now, if the DJ got it wrong, what's the worst possible track in Aftermath that he could choose instead of Lady Jane? Over to you, Mark.
Well, you're probably ahead of me here, listeners. It was Under My Thumb. So Will said that his fiercely Presbyterian father-in-law was not amused by this. So he says, it was a tribute. So he says, please, silence. We're going to play this song. And the first dance is about to be, you know, and the wife.
No, it's coming down the aisle, wasn't it? It's coming down the aisle. I
think it might have been, or it might have been the big opener for the, you know, for the two of them, you know, at the reception. But it's my thumb.
You can never rehearse too many times. It doesn't matter what it is.
It's like something from a Richard Curtis movie.
Because if it can go wrong, it will go wrong.
Incredible.
Murphy's Law, isn't it?
As we used to call it.
Anything further to add? We've got a couple of new Patreon supporters. Is that right, Alex? Do you like to read out their names?
Indeed. Yes, I do. We have on board Martin Pridmore.
On board,
Martin.
And because on board is more than just a metaphor with this particular podcast, because one of the three of us is currently on board an ocean liner.
Indeed.
On the Briny, and it's not me and it's not Mark. Okay? So when he says on board, he knows whereof he speaks. Okay. And any more?
Number two?
Skipping up the gangplank is Rob Collis, who's a birthday patron.
All right, okay. So that means we'll be shinning down Rob's digital drain pipe at some point in the coming months to mark his birthday by inspecting his record collection.
Very good.
Patreon supporters can also look forward to a new exclusive service that have we launched this yet, Alex, or it's coming any day now?
Dropping this week.
Dropping.
Dropping, as the kids say.
Dropping.
Which is
a Z in it, as in dropping.
Which is called Down the Rabbit Hole, wherein we pursue our strange and arcane rock and roll enthusiasms, hopefully in to your edification detail and amusement. So patreon.com/wordinyourear to find out more about all of that.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.